Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
This is the Counter-Rock brought to you by the Irish Times, sponsored by Nifty Business. You can find out more at niftybusiness.ie. My name is Nathan Johns. I'm joined in studio here by Irish Times rugby correspondent Jerry Thornley, as well as rugby writer John O'Sullivan. And we are here to talk through Ireland's 38-17 demolishing, really, of France. Good morning, Jerry. The game was in Marseille. There was a lot of talk in the build-up about the atmosphere. It was in close to the southwest heartlands of French rugby. Jerry, did the Velodrome live up to expectation?
To hear the Marseillaise sung like that in Marseille was quite exceptional. I actually recorded it. It really was spine-tingling, magnificent version of it. The atmosphere was rocking beforehand. They know how to do a pre-match build-up in France certainly better than they are if you're doing the Aviva. Like, they turn off all the lights, everybody turns on their phones, they start chanting Allez le Bleu. It's a magnificent cantilevered kind of undulating stadium. It's magnificent atmosphere from it. Crowd were very up for it, 67,000, great Irish contingent there. And when the French started off and Jalibert has that little dart and they go out wide right and Ficou probably gives the pass too early to Penno, you're thinking, oh, damn, the French have turned up here tonight. And then I noticed after about 10 minutes up until about the red card for Willemse, it was such good commentary on the Irish performance that the crowd were actually quite becalmed. And it was relatively quiet. And you could even hear the fields of Athenry during the first half an hour of the game, quite audibly. And then when Willemse got the red card, even the French crowd couldn't complain because it was so obvious. Not even the French, they just couldn't even boo that decision. It was so obvious he was going to get the red card. But it did make them angry, and it did start. That's when they started getting into the game then, as they tried to influence the referee and tried to influence the officials. Succeeded spectacularly so when that ridiculous penalty was reversed for Jack Crowley winning the ball in the air ahead of Gael Ficou. When the French TV director in the crowd earned that penalty. But they got angry and they got certainly into the game, the two power surges that led to the French tries. But by and large, they were pretty becalmed, and by the end, they were just reduced to booing the Irish fans for sitting in the fields of Athenry. It was quite a lovely sound.
I think, yeah, you look at it from a perspective of they were out of control a little bit initially. Like, Valença has a late hit on Doris before he gets the Porter shot, and then he does it again. And there is an element of, I think, the captaincy here with Gregory Aldrich. It's just trying to get them to focus on playing rugby and doing what they're supposed to be doing. And France seemed very distracted for much of that first half until they got their dander up towards, well, I was going to say towards halftime, but you're right, for those two tries, it just seemed that they were focused all of a sudden, and then they scored tries.
Yeah.
And then they became distracted again by whatever it was. They just weren't feeling it. And then Ireland's performance gradually, Valença sending off and Ireland's increasing control on the game pushed them to the periphery, basically.
I don't want to spend too long on it because I think, as you said, Jerry, even the French had nothing to complain about with that decision. So I don't want to dwell on it too long, but I think it is worth mentioning that obviously that decision to send off Willemse, I think, what he made two or three, I think you mentioned, he made three tackles there in that first half, two of which were were cardable offences. I guess the only debate is, should he have been given a straight red before, and should he have actually had the opportunity to come back onto the pitch?
Well, yeah, the first one was on Porter, and neither is actually a tackle. They're just cheap shots. Well, the first one on Porter isn't a tackle. It's a clear out.
Yeah.
It's a very high clear out. And Porter, yes, it was argued that he went low, but Porter was a low target to begin with, and Willemsen would have seen that and still went through with the high shot. I personally thought he was going to get red. That was my initial reaction at the time. When it was declared that he was only getting a yellow and he was coming back on, I was surprised. And then the second one, Brook, no argument. He goes in, it's even higher. You could argue that one on Porter was more dangerous because it's a shoulder to the forehead, whereas with Doris, it's a shoulder to the neck, chin area. I think the bunker review official had no option but to upgrade that to red, in part because it was a second offence, or maybe even a third.
It was almost comical. The start of the second half, he's already been given his red card because it was a second yellow. The bunker could have saved himself some time almost.
Yeah.
And Carl Dixon at the start of the second half has to call both captains over and say, sorry lads, do his X, take out his red card and brandish it all over again. They have their procedure to follow, don't they? But it was a bit of an unnecessary few seconds.
I think Jerry summed it up perfectly there. You have that Paul Valencia is three strides away from Andrew Porter. Andrew Porter doesn't drop his height in that time. He's lower.
No, he's already
already standing there. He's made a tackle. So Valencia's coming in to clear out. Porter doesn't change his height. And Valencia still hits him. I thought it was nailed on red. I don't understand how you can possibly mitigate it or say that Porter dropped. He didn't drop. He was at that height. He was lower than if he was standing upright. But Valencia comes three strides away. He can hit Porter wherever he wants. And he chose to go in high. And you know, if they're going to be consistent about this in the game, you have to make those red cards. There's no argument about it. And the fact that he did it again, you know, if Doris is injured after he's done that to Porter, I think that we're having a different conversation here.
True, that's a good point, yeah.
And I don't think that you can find a way to fudge these decisions. We can possibly, we get into talking about French TV directors later on and, you know, replays, no replays, all this sort of stuff, but it makes a joke of the Six Nations when you get 47 replays for one incident and no replays for another.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the tournament
organizers, the French media complained long and hard about this is what happens at the Aviva Stadium, the reverse. But I think they're the worst offenders of all. The other thing about it as well is, in all the years I've been going to France and in all the years I've seen a player get a yellow or red card and be sent off the pitch, I've never heard such few complaints from a French crowd. They when the replays were being shown of the two high shots, you could hear the Irish crowd in the ground booing because they was just horrible to watch. And then when he gets the red card, not even the French crowd could boo about it because they just had to say, yeah, he's a goner. It was a fait accompli. The other thing about it as well is that Galtier afterwards mentioned the red card several times, as a losing coach always will. It's their get out of jail. And I've no doubt that maybe Willems' presence there, or if they'd had a full 8-man pack, maybe the two Maul tries don't happen at the end. Maybe it's a factor in how well Ireland's Maul went and how generally well they defended the French Maul. But it actually got their dander up for the first time in the match. And then again, they come back in the second half, they get back to within a score a second time. But in actual fact, if you look at it, in the 32 minutes where it's 15 against 15 or 14 against 14, Ireland win that match 17-3. They used, and when they've got the man advantage, they win at 21-14. In other words, when they were man down was when France got their two tries. So for me, Walshie also came down to me at halftime, tapping the shoulders, that there's no way Ireland are going to lose this match unless they lose themselves. They're so much the better team. And watching it again made me realise how much more they actually were the better team, better coached, perform much better. I mean, France have got serious. That's a humiliating night for France. We could talk about them later. But Ireland were by far the better team, with or without Paul Willemsen getting a red card.
Just on that very, very quickly, because it was something I wanted to bring up. And I think you're right. The coach is always going to talk about a red card almost as a deflection tactic, because I think Damien Galtier has a lot of questions to answer. France had a world-class line-out at the World Cup in last year's Six Nations, and then they don't pick their best line-out operator in Cameron Waukee. They leave him on the bench. Ireland's line-out does a job on them. Ireland had a historically poor line-out. They fixed that, but equally defensively they were excellent as well. And they had six forwards on the bench. and they didn't use the lock. Paul Willems is 127 kilos going off. And like you say, Ireland scored two mole tries with him off the pitch. I think for the second one, they had emptied their bench. They hadn't for the first. But there's still, what, was half an hour gone when he gets sent off? You've got six forwards on the bench. You've got 6-2. I know you want that impact at the end. But if you've got six forwards on the bench and you've lost that much heft, why are you not making a change almost immediately to compound the fact that you probably picked the wrong second row in the first place?
Yeah, bring Walkie on and sacrifice a back. Yeah, makes perfect sense. They should have done that for sure.
Well,
yeah.
he's athletic. The other thing that you bring on, or like Walkie is a brilliant athlete, so he covers a lot of ground. So it's not like he's giving you something that Valencia doesn't give in terms of athletic prowess as well. So it makes even more sense to bring somebody on in that vein, because Cameron Walkie can also play in the back row. So he's very, very athletic, and he would have given France a different dimension, and you still would have had somebody and a very athletic forward to throw to in the lineout. So I don't understand that. And going back to Gerry's point as well, I think like Ireland probably left two tries behind them when it was 15-on-15. And at that time you thought, oh no, not another one of these nights where, you know, are they going to rue not finishing off those opportunities? And as things transpired, they didn't, and they were able to see out the game in a very comfortable and emphatic way. So I think that talking about Fabian Galthi and his decisions, he spoke beforehand about matching intensity and physicality and taking it to Ireland and all that sort of stuff. And there seemed to be a preoccupation with France for the first few minutes. And then they just seemed to lose their way. Like there was a point where there was a great wide angle camera shot looking at it. And it was like watching Ireland had the ball and France were defending, and it was like watching in a golden oldies game, watching France in defence, they kind of shuffled sideways. Fiku came out of the line to put some speed into it. The rest of them realised half a second later that, oh, you should be doing something like this. And it was just, they're very passive and soft at times.
I think also though that, this goes back to my earlier point about them, Ireland just looking a vastly better coached side, and particularly in their attacking game, but also the defensive game. For me, helped by the line-out having a perfect return of 13 and helped by the French losing four, and even those bare statistics don't tell the truth, because so much of the quality of the French ball was actually quite poor, because O'Mahony was putting great pressure on, or Tyke Byrne was putting great pressure on, and it said like two steals. I think there was three. I think at the end you give Ryan Baird credit for that last steal as well. Not that it mattered by that stage. So great day for the line-out, and that was a huge factor, because all five Irish tries emanated from line-outs. We know it's the lifeblood of the Irish attacking game, and therefore there must be a little element of Paul O'Connell and Andy Farrell and the players, and it's occurred to me.
Was anything said after the match about the lineout?
Not much, I don't remember, but I'm just thinking there must be a part of them thinking, why the hell didn't it work like that against the All Blacks in the quarterfinals? What difference it would have made? Anyway, that's gone. I didn't want to come here and talk about the bloody World Cup again. It's gone. Goodbye. Go away. Hallelujah. Six Nations back.
Who had 12 minutes in the World Cup sweepstakes?
Yeah. But for me, Nathan and John, for me, Ireland won the game line because their attacking game was so much better. The amount of times that there is a dummy decoy runner that's keeping defenders guessing. Like Dante is flat-footed by Tyke Byrne's break because he's expecting to go out the back to James Lowe. And there's just so much more nuance. And then on top of that, Irish players, like I'm going through it again, like Josh van der Vleer, footwork game line. Caelan Doris, footwork game line. Joe McCarthy, footwork game line. Whereas I remember there was one move in the first half. They had a line out. I think it might have been after Jack Crowley's one out in the full. No, another one. On the Irish 10-metre line, they have a line out. Their maul gets no traction. And they go, and it's up the middle from Dante, and it's stopped 5 metres behind the gain line. Luku throws out a wounded duck of a pass, I think, to Aldred, who's nailed by
McCarthy.
And it ends up Luku kicking. So they ended up starting on the Irish 10-metre line, end up in their own half and kicking. And that's an example of how Ireland won the game. And that line speed stayed all the way throughout the game. You've got to give Jack Crowley a lot of credit for that. Dan Sheehan, I didn't realise how good Dan Sheehan was until I watched it again. Like, not just the 10 carries, the brilliant darts, the try, but his tackle execution. I think he might have been the leading tackler. 10. And the other thing as well is they did their homework so much better. They saw the big carriers, the straight runners like Dante and so forth. They knew your man Tulagi was going to come on. He might add some freshness. And the amount of times they went low on him and brought him down, whether it was Conan, James Ryan, Josh van der Vleer, whoever it was, they were just all going low on this guy. And I just thought they were just a vastly better prepared coach side. And it exposed that They're now money on favourites, odds on favourites, just to win the Six Nations, but even the Grand Slam. And France, whoa, that defeat for them, like that's got echoes of Ireland's opening defeat in 2019. You remember the ripple effect that had on Ireland for a long while to come?
Yeah, the England game, yeah.
I think that's going to be similar for France, I really do.
Well, yeah, that's
a big call.
I think. Well, it's interesting because now all of a sudden, if you look at and like keep in their player ratings, as they often do, sharpen the scalpel when France lose, and the halfbacks got 3 out of 10 each, Maxime Moukou and Mathieu Jalibert. Galfi has a decision to make now. Like he was talking about, these are the Bordeaux halfbacks that have attacked brilliantly all year in terms of their club form, have four of that Bordeaux backline, and we spoke to Noel McNamara obviously on the pod last week. Galfi has a decision to make in terms of not being knee-jerk here, because if he goes for Nolan Le Grec, who played well when he came on,
and certainly speeded up
the game for them, and then starts to look at, okay, well, how do I change this? Or do I need to change this? And it would be a fundamental shift to go from we're happy and we're content and we're going to get rid of the World Cup headache in our first match to getting a spanking at home in Marseille, and then turning around and going, well, yeah, all I said last week doesn't actually apply now. I've got to make, you know, 3, 4, 5 changes, going to Murrayfield, where they don't have a good record and tend not to play well. Like, that's a tough ask for
them. They could go two down.
Easily. Yeah.
It's funny you say that. My French isn't perfect, but I do get the Midi Olympique subscriber emails, and I'm pretty sure they were reporting this morning that Luku is still going to start next week, even after that, or at least reporting... not quite sure, but there's talk coming out of France that they maybe might not be so knee jerk.
Well, they've brought in two more young centres. So they've brought in the Bordeaux centre, Nicolas Deportaire, who played against Ireland in Junior World Cup last year, and they've brought in Emile Gaëtan, who played against Ireland in the Ireland under 20s, I should say, in the Six Nations last year. He is the Poe fella.
He's outstanding.
Brilliant. The two of them are.
He was a top try scorer in the top 14 last season. A young centre.
Great hands.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, people in France cannot understand why Galtier's not picking these lads. Like, Gael Ficou, with the best will in the world, is weary. He's played more minutes than anybody else on the pitch last weekend. Mind you, Tadhg Byrne was only just behind him, and that didn't seem to do him any harm. But, like, yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like, he went with a very short-term fix in the second row. He showed loyalty in midfield. He went with the established number two to Dupont, and none of these things have worked out well for him at all. So where does he go from here? And they've got a second row crisis now, with the Willems are likely to face a hefty ban, and Tafanua out, and even out, Thibaut Flamand's out.
Your point about going with physicality. So they picked Yoram Moefana on a wing, who's ostensibly a centre. I know he's played wing for France, but they took off Louis Bielbieri, and when Bielbieri came on, they looked at a different prospect again a little bit with Nolan Le Grec at scrum half.
I think Bielbieri, the tempo he brought at scrum half changed the game.
It was a different France, and you were thinking, this is...
The only two times when they looked really like the French were very early on, when Jalibert had that counter from his own half, and also in the second half there was another counter which ended up with Bielbieri going up down the left wing, and they made great inroads there. But generally they're not allowed counter from their own half, because Galtier and Edwards are so prescriptive, they just kick the ball. And they're just kicking it directly to James Lowe. Mm-hmm. And it's going back with interest.
But it's funny you say that. France kicked the ball 20 times out of hand. Ireland 33. You don't see teams out kicking France very often. As you say, there is the prescriptive. We've mentioned it 1,000 times now, but we've all seen the Netflix clip from last season. Sean Edwards, where we're in our half, you kick the you-know-what ball. France went away from that game plan, and it cost them. And like you said, James Lowe was brilliant. His left foot was fantastic. Ireland kicked for 300 plus more metres than France. And as we all know these days, generally speaking, there's a pretty good correlation between the team that kicks for the most metres tends to win the game. And you mentioned there, they kept kicking to James Lowe, and it, like you said, came back with interest.
Yeah, I didn't think they did go away from their game plan so much. I think the only two times they did, they looked more French than any other points in the game. I think they should be given more license to that. Remember as well that brilliant try Damien Penault got in the Aviva last season. Galtier was practically giving out about that after the game, because they went off script. Yeah. I think a pass went to ground and Ramos had to scoop it up off the ground.
Ran backwards, and it looked like, to all intents and purposes, that Ireland were going to nail him.
Yeah.
And he escaped.
And he escaped. And they scored. But that was that. France aren't given liberty, license to do that.
It was so French. You're right. So French.
Their attacking game seems to have gone backwards. So much of their attack is based on turnover ball. Their defence is their primary source of attack. And when their defence is, that line speed has been negated, like Ireland did, they look almost a little bit blunt. All they had going for them was their close-in power game, the one-off carries, the one bang, 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 until eventually Penno sweeps in around his wing and he's on Jalibert's shoulder. But like their starter plays were poor. Ireland's starter plays were way better, more varied, more nuanced, more decoy runners, getting over the gain line consistently every time. France's starter plays were just trucking up the middle every time.
I think they were panicked and they were muddled. So
I just don't think they look very well coached, John.
When they were, and there would be an element of that. I suppose in some respects you're looking for the players to take responsibility here. So out in the pitch, whatever game plan you go in with, you still require your players to be able to problem solve on the pitch. So they still have to think for themselves, play the game that's in front of them, you know, tweak whatever's required. France weren't able to do any of that. They just went, okay, we're supposed to be kind of trucking this up in a very direct, physical way. We're going to match Ireland's intensity. They got some ball. They got slow ball. They got hit behind the gain line. They never thought about what they were doing. They just kept doing the same thing. And it was only, as you say, towards, you know, when they got their dander up a bit and they got a little bit of if you like, go forward through the gain line with some powerful carries, that you saw what they could accomplish. But as quickly as that materialised, it was gone again in the second half.
I want to move on slightly more to Ireland.
We were very
lucky on Thursday night to be joined by Mr. Jacques Nienaber at our live event previewing the Six Nations. John was on stage with Gordon Darcy and Jacques, and he made a really interesting point, and I think we're going to play it now, about how when he was coaching against Ireland at the World Cup, South Africa wanted to target Ireland physically, and what he said was very interesting.
The Ireland game, I think, our mindset there was probably to go at them from a physical point of view, and that's where they just were more physical than us. They just out-physical South Africa. And I think that sometimes there's always two narratives. Sometimes there's the Irish media that drive a narrative, and then there's the South African media that drive a narrative, and then somewhere in between there's the truth.
So that was Jacques Nienaber. He also made the point that everyone considers South Africa to be a heavier team than Ireland. He said if you add up the weights and divide by 23, I think Ireland were a kilo heavier. Now, I think that might be James Lowe versus Cheslin Kolbe making up that difference
for
Ireland. But you do the same for France. In the forwards, which I think is where it is slightly more important than overall, in the forwards, Ireland were giving up 6 kilos a man to the French. But that said, when Mr. Nienaber, one of the, you know, back-to-back winning, World Cup winning coach, is saying Ireland are out physically in South Africa, is it perhaps such a surprise then, what you were talking about earlier, that they managed to nullify the French power game the way they did?
No, I don't think so, because I've heard Nienaber say this to us before, that they never thought that South Africa had a big physical edge over it. I think it's been a bit of a myth, largely down to Will Skelton, really, in the Saracens against Leinster and La Rochelle against Leinster, that and the damage he's done in those games. But I still think in last year's final of the Champions Cup, if James Ryan doesn't get concussed after 30 minutes, Leinster win that match, because he'd completely negated Will Skelton that first half hour, and Skelton only came to life after that half an hour was up, when James Ryan went off. I think Leinster were winning 23-7 at the time. You saw what happened. I went to La Rochelle this season and they did a number on Skelton then, particularly Ryan and McCarthy. And we saw that Will Skelton had very little impact in that game. It was like 10 carries for about 14 metres or something like that. It wasn't discernible. And so I think there's a bit, it's become a dog-eared script, and it's just become a little bit of an inaccurate cliche as well, that, you know.
But that's the point. It's probably time to put that narrative away, size.
And also then, if you have big athletes like Joe McCarthy with brilliant footwork, and Doris with footwork, and Conan with footwork, and Van der Fleer, and then you've got a more nuanced attack as well that has decoy runners running off the ball and making defending. It's a great, that short passing game and crowding of midfield and having lots of options, it keeps defenders guessing. And it's amazing how many times you look from behind the goal and they show you behind the goal and it's always 5 against 4 or 4 against 3, how they're outnumbering defences. That will keep anybody like Fico or Dante honest, or Skelton or whoever.
Yeah, I think I just want to make the point that two people who deserve huge credit here are Jamison Gibson-Park and Mike Catt. Mike Catt, the way Ireland set up an attack, the subtlety and nuances to the way they attack, the involvement with backs and forwards, that rounded 15-man approach, you know, the carrying, going out the back, making good decisions, it all falls on it. And also credit to Jack Crowley as well, in terms
absolutely.
Of how he managed the game. I think
absolutely.
When you look at a couple of errors in the first half, I think it shows a lot of character and courage, and he has that in spades, to keep playing, not to hide, not to drop deeper, not to kind of become introverted in, you know, in the way you play, which will hurt your team. But I think Jamison Gibson-Park, his choice of pass, his choice of, if you like, to pick out receivers, where he goes to, his vision, I think it's massive for Ireland.
Yeah, no, he had a brilliant game. And his ground coverage and the work rate and, you're right, the decision making and so forth. He just had a super game. But Crowley, if you look at the build up to the first try by Gibson Park, he does the loop around Bundy and takes right up the line and gives it out to Lowe and knows he's going to get smashed by Dante. Gets smashed by Dante, but from the recycle, Robbie Henshaw, lovely hands. There's a disconnect slightly on the edge. Ramos is hanging back too much. Bundy gets free, pops the ball inside to Gibson Park, who actually, if you look at it again, he does the faintest and faintest and faintest of dummy passes, which completely checks Damien Penno. Otherwise, Penno gets him.
Yeah.
It's brilliant, actually. On the second try,
He
gets smashed again.
By Navaca.
But he's called it before the ball's been recycled. He's telling Tyke Byrne what he's going to do. He shapes as if he's might going to give a pass out the back to James Lowe sweeping. Dante is, I think Dante thinks it's going that way.
Well, he is.
And he gives a short little pass to Byrne. Yeah. Great angle. So while he's making these mistakes, missing the penalty, the grubber that went dead, the kick out in the foot, he's still playing beautifully. Right up the line, square on. Hardly put a foot wrong in the second half. And then those three conversions. All those three tries into 7-pointers. I thought given that he's only 24, given he's relatively little rugby at half, given he was succeeding in one of the greatest of all time, how well he played out there, it's going to give him the world of confidence and the team confidence in him.
But what I'd say is, like, if you're looking to distill it down into a sentence or two, Jack Crowley before the game was, the question was, could he inherit and fill Jonathan Sexton's jersey?
Whoa. Exactly.
Going to France to play in Marseille in a volatile atmosphere. Yeah. And the answer to that question was, okay, how would he fare if there were one or two errors in his game? Like, he coped brilliantly with everything that was thrown at him. He added value, so much value at times, in the way he played. And I think if you're looking at it just from that perspective, you just say, yeah, Jack Crowley stepped up and filled the jersey. And that's all you can do. Will he get better? Yeah. Like, anybody who saw Crowley play in the season 2020 when he played for the 20s, scoring tries the length of the pitch, understands that this young guy has talent.
So. And he missed a year's rugby effectively because of the pandemic.
Correct. Yeah.
Just he was bad timing for him, that age group. Missed a year's rugby. Then he's back playing rugby again. I remember I bumped into him once, having a coffee in the Orange Goat and Balls Bridge, and he was down in Dublin with the 7 squad. He just happened to be walking past, and that's... But the poor lad wasn't playing it because there was no AIL.
No,
a year not playing rugby.
Desperate for games.
Yeah, and then he comes back into the Munster environment and he doesn't get much time, particularly 10, bit of 12, bit of 15, because Joey Carby and Ben Healy and others are all there. JJ was probably still there at the time as well. Like, so if you actually look at it, I wouldn't say he's even played 40 matches at out half.
He couldn't see in another life. He could be down with Roger and La Rochelle.
Well, he couldn't play. The one thing that what was surprising, I suppose, at the time is that Johan van Graan preferred others at out half. He didn't get a lot of game time in Munster, but he didn't get a lot of game time at 10 in Corcon. He actually played full back because they had Aidan Moynihan, I think, playing 10, and they didn't want to disrupt the system of Moynihan playing 10.
That's
so Jack Crowley played 15.
I went
15.
To Clontarf Corcon semi final in the AIL, and he was an impact replacement the last year, and he lit the game up when he came on. But I think you're right. He might even been a 12 or 15 when he came. But yes, you're right. He didn't even start that match. You're right.
So
he's
amazing.
He's had relatively little rugby for a 24-year-old compared to what Roger would have had at that time or what Johnny would have done, even when Johnny came into the team. So he's only going to get better and better and better.
Sure.
He's got footwork. Dricko used to say that he was a bit too side on giving the ball. I've watched that closely now in the last few games, particularly I thought on Friday night. He's very square on. And that's what's helping to keep defenders guessing as well. So I just, he's getting better and better and better. But that end of season run in with Munster to the URC title was probably his first real extended run at 10.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's building up game minutes in a 10 jersey.
Yeah.
And you're starting. And
it's only his fourth start for Ireland.
Ireland supporters should be excited by the fact that this young guy has stepped up in Marseille, and the future, without putting the markers on him, he just needs, there's aspects of his game that need to improve. But he has the talent and he has the aptitude based on everything that we saw last Friday night. And he's got to prove it again and again and again. There's no point in doing it one-off.
And as Nathan says, he's next moment focused. Yeah. He's got a very composed temperament. He's a bit of a rock star, let's be honest about it. No, he is. You know, he's got that certain something about him. It's that little bit of Rog, Corcon, Munster, 10 thing, you know? No harm, because you need that as a 10.
Oh, very much so.
He's intelligent too, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Bright boy.
Yeah. On that positive note, we're going to take a quick break and we'll continue chatting about Ireland in a few minutes.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome back to the Counter Rock with me, Nathan Johns. We're still here with Jerry Thornley and John O'Sullivan. One man we haven't mentioned before we go off Ireland, John, and you've written about him in Monday's Irish Times, is Tadhg Byrne. We were just talking there during our little break about how in another day he should have been man of the match, arguably should have been regardless, but you know, the romantic idea of giving it to a 22-year-old McCarthy in his first start rang true. But John, you've written about Tadhg Byrne. We've talked about how impressive McCarthy was. What impressed you?
Everything about his work. His work rate, his willingness to step up and lead. He called a line out. The line out was 13 from 13. He took the first, I think in the first 82 seconds of the game, he called the first two balls on himself. He took responsibility for that. The line out worked perfectly. He was a factor at the breakdown and slowing down ball. He carried, he ran obviously a brilliant line for his try and facilitated by Jack Rowley's lovely soft hands. He picked a great angle to do that. Just every time you looked around and needed you were looking at an Irish player to do something, he was invariably there. He was there, you know, whether it was at the breakdown, you know, looking after the line out, carrying ball. He played with just a great intelligence, and he led. He led by example. And I don't know whether it's the fact that he is likely to be, I think, Munster captain and succeed Peter O'Mahony, but it sits very easily. Responsibility seems to sit very easily. And what struck me about his performance as well was I thought I was looking at Tadhg Byrne back in his Scarlets days when we used to rave about him as an athlete, his ability to get round the pitch, carry, run. Like, he's just... I just thought he had a brilliantly consistent impact throughout the whole game. I thought it was a great performance.
The other thing that's extraordinary about Tadhg Byrne is that he played every minute of the World Cup. He played every minute of the warm-up match. I think it was against England or Samoa. That was six games every minute. He's come back to Munster. He's played eight games for Munster every minute. He's played well over 1,100 minutes, the most of any Irish rugby player this season. He's had the additional responsibilities, as you say, of being captain of Munster. To be honest, I thought it was weighing him down a little bit. I thought he played quite well in Toulon, but none of his Munster performance again. Where this is like Bundy earlier, I was talking about, and now Tadhg Byrne as well. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is about the Irish environment, it just seems to refresh, recharge, refocus, and they just go back in and they all start playing their best rugby again. Like James Loeb's performance.
Yeah.
You know, outstanding. Yeah. Bundy Aki, Robbie Henshaw, excellent. But Tadhg Byrne and any other, he made 12 carries, the most of any player. And as you said, the lineup calling themselves, and he goes 80 again.
Yes,
you mentioned statistics there, John.
You made two clean breaks to the most of any player in the match.
Exactly, right. John. You can find it in John's piece, which you can find in the Six Nations section of our website, irishtimes.com. But you did list all those statistical categories. Second behind Aldred in carries, third in metres made, most by a forward, most line breaks joint, most passes by a forward, second most attacking rucks hit, most defensive rucks hit, and then likewise you said that the five lineouts, which was there or thereabouts.
I think Jerry touched on a point there, and I think it's very it's an interesting one. If you look at, so in the Ireland environment, there seems to be a little bit of pressure in most positions for your position, and maybe that is something, that culture in itself is you're under pressure to perform all the time, good pressure to perform. So, you know, and you take it, if you look at Ireland's second row options, you've got, obviously, Tadhg Byrne and Joe McCarthy starting, you've James Ryan on the bench, and at one point you saw on the sideline Ian Henderson in a bib. So you understand that there are options there, and Andy Farrell is challenging the players to play, and maybe the players are responding to that. Maybe there's a touch with when you're back at your province and you're a big fish in a small pond. Maybe there's a syndrome where you don't have to.
Yeah, and also they had such an injury crisis in the second row of Munster this season that's why they have to keep going back to Tadhg Byrne. He had to play every week. Remember you asking me about Joe McCarthy's selection, Nathan, last Thursday in the captain's run in the Velodrome? And I said to you, I really thought it was a brilliant selection. I thought not only was he comfortably the form, all the stats, he was comfortably the form lock in Irish rugby this season, but that the selection of a 22-year-old like him, with his attitude, his energy, his fizz, would be infectious for older players. Very often an older player who's been there a while, it gets a young teammate comes in who just starts tearing it up, and it gives them a lift too. And it probably gave Tadhg Byrne a bigger lift than any other player in the team, having this young Big Joe, as Andy calls him, beside him, because he's a phenomenon. And in actual fact, yeah, he probably deserved man of the match, but you said, you gave the romantic notion.
Next time you come on, you got to say young Big Joe in your best Wigan accents.
Young Big Joe.
I don't want to bring the tone down, but I do need to ask the question, given those three penalties in the first half were what allowed France to score that try just before half time. They camped in the 22 because there were three scrum penalties, and all three were against Andrew Porter. He gave away three penalties against New Zealand. Now, BJ Botha, funnily enough, the former Munster prop, is on Twitter analysing all these scrums, and he actually thinks one of them was very harsh against Porter, as he did, I'm pretty sure, during the World Cup as well. But perception versus reality, it doesn't really matter. As long as there's a perception of illegality, there's a problem. Is this becoming a bit of an issue?
Yes, clearly a bit of an issue. And I remember asking John Fogarty about this last week in the Algarve at one of the media days, and he said, yeah, it is a concern, the pictures that are being presented to referees, and maybe even a bit of a preconceived notion amongst the refereeing fraternity now about Andrew Porter. The one of the aerial shots does show him scrumming at an angle. Another one doesn't show him scrumming at an angle at all. You go back to the All Blacks game, I think he was very harshly treated that day, and it wasn't just... it was also Alex Corbusiero on his Twitter feed also questioned two of the penalties.
Well, he's actually worked with World Rugby.
Yeah.
Whenever Mike Cron's the World Rugby scrum guru,
yeah,
whenever he took a bit of a break, Corbusiero was actually the guy setting the scrum rules for World Rugby.
I think he's getting unfairly treated, Andrew Porter, but yes, it's an issue.
I was going to say, just on that note, you've got to remember that there are two assistant referees and a referee looking at the scrum, because a lot of these penalties are called in by the assistant referee.
Yep.
So you have three different interpretations. It's like the three of us going to a match and we all look at a scrum and we all might come up with different conclusions as to who's doing what to whom.
Mm.
And more often than not, that is the case.
Yeah.
And if you look at the match...
And then you might get a referee like Wayne Barnes who said, not for me, mate.
Yeah, no. And I think the thing is that, you know, a couple of those, I think Andrew Porter's been a little bit hard done by as well. I think it is a concern, definitely, because you can't keep going through matches and they're that focus being there, if you like, or, you know, being penalised. But I think for two of the penalties, it was called in by the assistant referee.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even Carl Dixon that's doing this. And that must be frustrating for props, because you've got three different people with three different ideas, potentially.
Who's the English prop who got pinged the last minute late scrum for Andre Pollard to win?
Was it Genge?
His hand touches the ground briefly.
It was a loose head, I think it was Genge, and it touched the ground briefly,
and it goes back up.
But that was Ben O'Keefe. He was on that side of the
ground. I know. But all I'm saying is, Nathan, is like it's a World Cup semi-final. The kick goes over. It costing the place in the World Cup final. Is the punishment?
Does it fit the crime?
Fit the crime. I mean.
Well, BJ Botha says it in the very first, so he examines some
decisions.
Of the...
These are big decisions. These are 3 points or maybe seven.
He examines the first Andrew Porter penalty, whereas you see Porter's arm going out on the ground as if to say, like, I'm not the one that's lost my footing here. And it's called in as a penalty. And this rush, and this is the problem, there's lots of problems in relation to the laws, the game, and what you're doing and various aspects of the game. This rush to try and get scrums finished... If you're going to have scrums in a match, you've got to say it's a necessary evil, we'll call it,
with all
due respect
to
the front row people who are listening to this and love scrums. Mike Ross in particular, obviously, who feels that the old goal line dropout should never have come into the game and it should have more scrums in the game. But if you're going to have them, you have to be fair to people. People slip.
The other thing as well, Nathan, as well, to mention in all this, yes, you can isolate the scrum penalties. But in the build-up to the Calvin Nash try, I think it's Doris trucks it up, and Winnie Antonio is out on his feet and just flops on the ground, and it's a line break. And you compare his work rate around the pitch over the hour he's on the pitch with the near 80 minutes that Andrew Porter invariably puts in, and you think of that crucial penalty won the second half. I think that actually might have been a little bit of a turning point. Was that not when they got back to 17-24
that
he won that? I mean, he offers so much around the pitch more than a lot of other props do. And yeah, there were a couple of penalties against him, but I still think on balance, was there many scrums of the match? Was there seven scrums of the match? Many rucks are there? Like, I still, give me Andrew Porter in the team.
There's no argument here about Andrew Porter. Andrew Porter, no, definitely. Like, you look, and Jerry's touching it there, you look at his contribution over, more often than not, 70-plus minutes in a match. You look at the amount of work he gets through, the carries, the tackling, everything that he brings to the team. No question that he's worth his place. The issue is that they have to go to, they have to find a way of persuading referees, or he has to change. It's probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
You've probably got to have to find it and say, look, just give him a fair crack, and then say to Andrew, right, okay, we need to offer better pictures, basically.
We should mention how well Keane Healy played too in the 10 minutes he's on the pitch for Porter and when he came on at the end.
He's always been an excellent scrummager, hasn't he?
Yeah, and he also, you could see the energy he was giving to, getting his hands on the ball a few times, and the energy he was given to that maul, one of the maul tries, he's right at the forefront of it.
Like, well, the best scrummaging hooker they have is Ronan Kelleher as well. So, like, he makes a difference when he comes on to scrummage. He is
good defender,
he is noted as a scrummager.
You say that, we should, before I get accused of, because that's a few times now, I've mentioned Porter, both on the Twitter on Friday night as well. I mean, the Furlong got obliterated in one scrum by the French replacement front row as well. So it's not just a Porter issue. There is probably, like you said, there's a wider picture issue sometimes in that Irish scrum, which no doubt they're working to fix. Before we go, we should mention the other matches that took place. Italy 24, England 27. Italy just fell short of a famous win in Rome. And then an absolute cracker, probably will turn out to be the game of the tournament. Scotland 27-0 up at one point. Wales coming back to make it 26-27, just falling short. I don't want to spend too long on these matches, but from an Irish point of view, like we said, that game in Cardiff was a cracker, but have you seen anything, open-ended question to either of you, anything that worries you from an Irish perspective in either of those two games?
No. Worry would be a strong word. I mean, I don't want to seem overconfident with only one round in that Ireland are shoe-ins now to win a Grand Slam. But say, for example, our next opponents, Italy, I thought definitely under Cassata they looked a little bit more pragmatic. They didn't run all the time. It was a bit more of a balance to their game, and yet there was still some wonderful attacking rugby, particularly in the two first half tries. I know there were disconnects in the English defence, but even so, they were really well taken. Having the two Garbisis together is a boon for them. Menoncello being back is great for them. I think Juan Ignacio Brex is a fabulous player, really underrated player. Montagliani, they've got a lot. They've still got a lot of the threats in the back line that they had under Crowley, but I think they're a little bit more pragmatic, albeit, as you said before and off air, their performance fell away badly in the second half against a not very good England team.
No, I think the other thing is that if you look at it, their discipline, like how many years do we talk about Italian discipline in matches? So being precise, being accurate, and then being disciplined as well.
They didn't give away as many penalties they normally do, I didn't think.
Not as many, but they gave, at crucial times, they released the safety valve, the pressure valve for England, and they gave away some soft stuff. They also, the scrum, which used to be a real strong point for Italian rugby,
hasn't been for a while now.
It's an issue for them. Some of their forward play was a little bit. The thing was that the try at the end, which was a great try and a great way to finish the game, put a little bit of a gloss on the scoreboard. They were leading at half time. They had played some cracking rugby.
They didn't
score
a point between the 30th and the 80th minute, did they?
No. And that's a worry because you can, and I know I had a quick look in the Italian papers and stuff like that, and it's upbeat as it should be. It's Gonzalo Caseda's first game. But if you look at the quotes from Michele Lamaro, their captain, who played very well, he was so frustrated afterwards. Mm. He was kind of saying, this isn't good enough. We shouldn't take too much from this other than the fact that we got a bonus point, fine. But the performance, as you rightly touched on, between the 30th and 18th minutes is just not good enough. And it's more grist to the mill for
Wales, Scotland, Warren Gatland. How does he do it? Like, I just wrote that Welsh team off completely before the game. Well, at 27-0 down, everybody wrote them off.
Well, the changes he made at halftime were huge.
But
half the pack, but Thomas Williams at nine.
That was
changed
the game.
Catalyst. Yeah. Their second row, Teddy Williams, is that his name?
Yeah.
Fantastic second half performance. And
Wainwright
was excellent. Rafael in the back row. I think what happened...
Like, Scotland were a little lucky in the end.
They were massively lucky.
Having led 27-0.
Well, I thought it was a great moment when Jonathan Davis, the former Welsh out half on BBC, screamed "Oh no!" into his microphone when there was a knock on towards the end. Kind of, so you know, his impartiality went out the window. But yeah, I think both defence coaches, the Scottish and the Welsh defence coaches, are probably looking for a new job at the moment. But yeah, it was a great comeback from Wales, and you've got to balance the fact that Scotland were mentally brittle. Like, there's no other way to describe it. You look at it, you're 27-0 up, you've got to apply yourself. You give Wales huge credit for the manner in which they came back. And you could see with every try that Wales scored in the second half, Scotland got retreated into, became more introverted in what they were trying to do. There was one stage there where I think Finn Russell kicked the ball back down the middle of the pitch four times in a row. Finn Russell wouldn't kick the ball down the middle of a pitch in a season four times in a row. That will tell you the mindset was just we need to get down the other end of the pitch. He would run it back.
Now, the only good thing from their point of view is, John, they would have, as Townsend more or less admitted afterwards, they would have been seriously scarred if they'd lost that game.
Oh, hugely.
Whereas they do have a win under their belts, and they do have a wounded France at home, slightly vulnerable France at home. I know it was three away wins in the opening weekend, but that ain't going to happen again. And it could be that Scotland will, with a home game now against France, could be 2-2, and then, you know, then it'll be the usual stuff from their media in particular, saying they're going to win the Six Nations.
Looking forward to coming to Ireland in the last weekend.
But
I do think,
you know, it's a big thing them getting that result.
It is. I think it's a tipping point for Scotland and France next weekend.
Yeah, it is.
Because you either go one way. France either rehabilitate, get back on track, or they go 0-2. Scotland go 2-0, 2-0, and they get momentum then going into the rest of the tournament. And then, they're kind of... They have that momentum, that confidence, and they can take it from there.
And England could conceivably beat Wales at home, couldn't they? Be 2-2 as well.
I think the pragmatic side of it, yeah.
Final word to you, John. We need to mention the 20s. You're the resident under-20s expert. I did watch most of the game. Very impressed with inside centre, Hugh Gavin. I thought Gleeson at number 8 as well. He's the most experienced player in that 20s side, so no surprise given his professional experience with Munster. He led the way as well. Just, I'll give you the final words. What did you make of their 37-31 win in Aix-en-Provence?
I thought they showed a lot of character. I mean, you talk about things being imperfect during a game and being able to react on the hoof. I thought they did a great job. I thought that they stuck at it. I think that the defensive side and Richie Murphy, I remember Richie Murphy has said this to me several times, that even during the Grand Slams, that the most difficult aspect to prepare for is trying to get the defence sorted out at under-20 level. Because it's a completely different dynamic. They've got all the attacking chops. They still have that. Hugh Gavin, you mentioned. Wilhelm de Klerk, the two centres are very good. I thought Jack Murphy, the out-half, had a super game. He was very composed, managed the game very well. Oliver Coffey is very good. So they have some very good young players. And even the, you know, two wings, Hugo McLaughlin playing out of position, normally a fullback, and Finn Tracy, who's a centre, playing on the wing. And then you go up front and Brian Gleeson looked like he was playing a junior cup match and he was a senior cup player. And that says a lot because he was playing against some very big guys. But I thought he was absolutely brilliant. And you can see that he leads. Joe Hopes was there from last year. Evan O'Connell, the captain as well. There were aspects of it. Mike Ross touched on it. He thought that the French got away with blue murder in the scrum. So there are aspects of it that they need to improve. France didn't pick maybe six players that they'll have in the Junior World Cup. Yeah. So, you know, everything is relative in that respect. I watched a bit at Wales and Scotland in the 20s as well. So I wouldn't be writing the eulogy for the third Grand Slam, but there's a lot to admire about the way they played and the character they showed. And
they kept playing, didn't they?
They kept playing. Exactly that. They kept playing. Even at the end of the match, you're thinking at some point, okay, safety first. Just kept trucking. Yeah. Carrying. Gain line, all the way up the pitch.
There's a touch of the Andy Farrell about Richie Murphy, isn't there? It's a similar kind of approach.
Yep. Very much so. He keeps playing. He lets them play. He says play with a heads up, and that's very, very important. And part of, if you look for a little bit of the DNA, the 20s DNA through their success, their Grand Slam success, getting to a World Cup final last year, is the fact that they play good rugby. They're good to watch. Mm. And that's three different teams, essentially, that you're looking at. So, yeah, huge credit to Richie Murphy for the way he enables, or he gives the team the license to go and play. And it's heartening. It's good to see. You'd like to see maybe one or two more players coming through from the 20s successful sides, if you like, the sides that have won Grand Slams, but we'll see.
Jesus, there's never been a weekend like it. You think of the history of Irish rugby. Nope. The Irish senior team and the under-20s going over and doing what they did last weekend.
Yeah, and the way they did it too. It's extraordinary.
On that positive note, we'll leave it there for today. My thanks to John O'Sullivan and Jerry Thornley. I've been Nathan Johns. This is The Counter-Up, sponsored by Nifty Business. We'll be back on Thursday. Very special guest joining us on Thursday to preview Ireland versus Italy. We'll be back then.